Getting our first 100 customers was impossible. It was so hard. Imagine selling with no website, stealth mode on my LinkedIn profile. Having a good sales methodology behind that was what I think kept us alive.
11 and a half years, how many actual near-death experiences do you think there was?
There was one really, oh my God, moment. We were down for 4 hours, but if we had not come back, we would have been dead.
What are the types of things you think about setting up day one?
I think number one is having a great enablement. You have to have a sales kickoff. Everybody in your sales organization needs to have a forecast. These are the things that are the non-negotiables.
Well, Chris, thanks for doing this.
Logan, thanks for having me.
So for people that aren't familiar, and I'm sure a lot of people are, but can you give a little bit of your background and maybe most relevant, your journey at Snowflake?
Yeah, sure. So I started Snowflake in November of 2013. As the first sales rep, we were in stealth mode, and I was the director of sales, hired by an interim CEO in Mike Speiser from Sutter Hill, and I worked with a bunch of founders. So I was like, depending on who you ask, either the 13th or the 16th employee at Snowflake, and from there became VP of sales under Bob Muglia, and then Bob then promoted me to chief revenue officer. And then Frank Slootman came in after they fired Bob. And 11 and a half years later, I retired or, stopped working at Snowflake most recently in May of 2025. So just very recently.
So you had four different CEOs along the way. I don't know if I've ever heard of anyone actually having gone on that journey. I guess, what do you think uniquely allowed you to survive and then thrive among such different leadership and transitions?
Well, first of all, I think throughout the entire journey, I probably had imposter syndrome and still do, thinking that I actually belonged in the seat. So high degree of insecurity along the way. I guess at the beginning, when Mike Speiser was recruiting me, I was really nervous about working for a company with no products, no customers, and really no CEO. Most importantly, no CEO, because the founders didn't want to be CEOs. And so, I said to Mike, it would be great for you to have someone on the board who cares about me, who knows about me. And he said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, at my last company, I had a little over a year stint. I had spent 8 years at EMC, and then I went to a startup in the security software space called Avexa, where a guy by the name of John McMahon was on the board. And so I got to go know John and really respect the heck out of John. And so I said, it'd be great for you to put someone like a John McMahon on the board. And I kid you not, Mike was on the board of a company called Sumo Logic with John, and had a board meeting the next day, asked John to be on the board of Snowflake, and said, okay, I've taken all your objections, off the table. So having a guy like John was incredibly helpful when Bob Muglia came on board. And there are two reasons. Number one is Bob had run 15,000 person organization at Microsoft, but he had never managed a direct sales force. And so there was a constant friction between finance and sales around what productivity means of a sales rep, how fast should we hire, and how do we measure. And really, John helped me deal with that in a number of ways. Number one is, are we getting enough leads for marketing? If we weren't, John's like, you've got to go fix that or you're going to get fired. And then he'd say, okay, don't let finance, treat, people who are employed for 3 months as, a quarter productive or whatever it is that you want to, or half productive. They're not productive until 6 months and a day. So he was really helpful in helping me negotiate headcount, rep to manager ratio, SE to, really the whole model, the whole sales go to market team, and helping me build that out. And that was so important along the way in the beginning. So Bob would not believe me sometimes and then go to John, and John would really validate what I was doing. And then I would ask John for a lot of help around what does productivity mean? How should I measure this? What does enablement look like? There's a whole bunch of things that John helped me and Bob with. And then, you know, when Bob got, I mean, I owe Bob a major part of my career, because even at my retirement party, Bob and Spicer were there, and Bob, you know, made sure to make a point of saying, you know, Mike wanted to bring someone in over me. And Bob had said, you know, I said to Mike, well, what are you looking for that Chris is not doing? And he said that, you know, look, Chris is hitting his number. He's hiring great people. He's, you know, driving a great culture in the organization. I'm unsure of what I'm trying to hire for. And really that was obviously, that was meaningful enough for Bob to then promote me to the chief revenue officer. And then, so I was devastated. I mean, really devastated when the board let Bob go. And Slootman, you know, even Bob and I joke, you know, there was no chance I thought you would keep your job under Slootman. And when Frank came in, you know, he was doing one-on-ones with the entire executive team. And I walked in and I said to Frank, the very first time I ever met Frank, and I said to him, I said, there's really two things, Frank, that I want from you is, number one, we were working on a real first $100 million deal, and Bob was right in the middle of that deal. And I said, so I'm going to need your help, with the CEO of that company. Number one. And then number two is, we have the best marketing department in the world, and you should not mess with that. And he's like, wow. He's like, you're the first one of your peers to walk in here in this one-on-one and not talk smack about, you know, your other peers. I'm like, well, I got nothing but good things to say about marketing. Now, I certainly had opinions about other people in the organization, but I think that, you know, set the tone right with Frank. And you know, ultimately, Frank and I, there were touch and go moments for sure. I had to make some material changes under Frank. Like, I had to change the entire organization, mid-year in terms of how we were structured. I had to fire a very senior leader in the team, and so there were some material changes that I had to make under Frank's watch, and we got through that. So the first 7-8 months were really, really, really brutal. But as I got to the other side with Frank, he and I developed this great relationship. And ultimately, you know, why I kind of lasted with four CEOs was, and I asked McMahon this, is he's like, you know, Chris, you listen, and then you don't come here with like, this is how it has to be. You're very much humble. You're listening, and then you'll take action. And he goes, you know, a lot of people in your situation, as you've seen success, you'll come in and you'll say, well, I know what I'm doing, and I'm not going to listen to anyone else. And I'd say, like, you know, I would hire people a lot of times more senior than me, working for me, and I would listen to them. The guy who ran APJ for me, in John Robertson, he way, way more senior guy than I am. And super helpful in so many ways. And he was kind of my sensei, if you will, towards the end, is he was really guiding me on a bunch of stuff. And even with Sridhar came in, and he's a very different manager than Slootman. He pointed out some pretty big holes I had in the organization. And I think when you have success, sometimes you can get, you know, fat and lazy, and Sridhar, very much, you know, was like, well, let's look at how do we optimize the sales team. And so I think, you know, Snowflake had a really great, first quarter, and the results were, you know, just came out, and I was super proud of the performance of the team. And I will take credit in that, we had to do some hard things through the course of last year. And those changes really were difficult, was mentally draining, but getting through those, now the organization's set up for success. So I think the net is I'll listen to people. I'll take feedback from anybody. It doesn't mean I'm going to do everything you tell me, but at least I'm going to contemplate it, think about it, internalize it. And then I'm not arrogant enough to say, like, you don't know what you're talking about. So.
Yeah, there are a lot of stuff I want to unpack there, but 11 and a half years, how many actual near-death experiences do you think there was that it could have gone one way and you ended up surviving? It sounds like at least two-ish that you referenced there, between the Spicer hiring someone over you, and then the first couple months, I guess, with Slootman might have been a little touch and go. But how many do you look back on and you think, you know, there was a fork in the road?
Well, as a company, there was one really, like, oh my God moment. When Snowflake was early days, we really went GA in 2015, in middle of 2015. And then in the middle of 2016, so around the August timeframe, we did a mid-year sales kickoff to kind of get everyone excited and saying, like, look, we got things are going great. And I brought the entire sales team we were in the W Hotel in San Francisco, and Bob Muglia is about to come out, and Bob's just this incredible motivational speaker. He's awesome. And I clearly remember this. I'm like, okay, I get the team all excited and I see a bunch of people checking their phones and I'm like, what's going on? And I'm like, all right, you know, give me 5 minutes. I got to go talk to Bob. And I walk into the hallway and Bob is white. And he's like, we're down. And I don't know if we're coming back. And
the product was down.
The product was down. And we were down, and the founders were like, you know, it was like open heart surgery. They were like trying to like pump the heart, and trying to revive the product. And so that like was scary. We were down for 4 hours, and we thought we had this great company, but if we had not come back, we would have been dead as a company. And I clearly remember that was a wild moment in the middle of a sales kickoff. And to Bob's credit, I said, Bob, we have a sales team here. You've got to go tell them it's going to be okay. You've got to make everyone excited about the opportunity. And to his credit, he got out there and did it. But that was like a company near-death experience. And then, you know, look, I think there's always, you know, I'm sure there's stuff I don't know about where people were thinking about replacing me. I think even when you go through a CEO transition, there is, you know, a high degree of possibility that, you know, the executive team changes. And when Slootman came in, the executive team changed. I mean, I think that the executive team has changed materially under Sridhar. So it happens. And you know, different leaders come in, come and go. But yeah, so I think that those were the kind of the big things when Bob came in, will I be the VP of sales? But then Spicer wanted to, you know, bring someone over me. And then Slootman, and he even admits there were times where he was unsure if I was going to make it. So those are the ones that I know about.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, if you're advising a company as you're now doing, or joining the board, or counseling go-to-market leaders within venture-backed businesses, what are the questions that you view as most important to figuring out the maturity of the sales organization and where some of the problems and bottlenecks potentially exist?
Well, there's just some basics that you kind of, so the good news for me is, you know, I learned a lot in terms of enterprise selling when I was at EMC, which is now part of Dell. But the guy who ran my division was a medic, focused sales leader. And so I learned the medic sales kind of methodology. And then there were, you know, constants that my direct manager was just, you know, maniacal about, and that just those things were ingrained in me, and so that was good. But when you go to these other companies, you realize they're not happening all the time, And so like, okay, number one is enablement matters a ton. So you need to have a world-class enablement that focuses on, you know, whatever methodology that you want to follow, but we follow Medic or MedPIC, because of course McMahon was on our board. I came from that methodology and I believe in that. That's a great compass, to drive, a forecast and understanding, you know, how real deals are and stuff like that. So, I think number one is having a great enablement, and focus investing in that. A lot of times it's hard because you're a startup, you're not making money, you're losing money. Hiring and spending money on enablement is scary, but it's so critical if you're going to go hire out an enterprise sales team. And then number two is it's just like the basics. Like you would be surprised on things like having forecast calls. Like you need to have a forecast call every week, and everybody in your sales organization needs to have a forecast call every week. And sometimes as Snowflake scaled, I thought because I did something, everyone else was doing it. Well, it turns out that's not even true. So you need to like babysit that and in a way figure out how you can micromanage it without being a micromanager. But forecast calls, one-on-ones, you know, enablement, like, you know, monthly, weekly enablement sessions, you know, team, your direct team meetings, those are the things that are like the non-negotiable. So like if I'm a founder and, you know, or I do this with the companies I advise, is like, this is the job description of the VP of sales, SVP of sales, CRO. This is what they are supposed to do. And if they're not doing that's okay. Here is their job description. They need to know that this is what their expectations are. Because sometimes these people that are the heads of sales don't come from the backgrounds that maybe I came from. So I'll help them. Like, you know, if you have someone that is really good at selling your product and a really good sales leader, but just needs some coaching, that's where I'll come in and say, okay, this is how we'll shape your day and your week and your and your month and your quarter. These are the things that are the non-negotiables. You have to do a quarterly business review. Like everybody in your organization has to do that. And these are things, you have to have a sales kickoff. Like these are things that people don't necessarily understand you have to do all. And it's kind of weird for me because it's second nature, but those are things that are missing a lot of times in organizations.
You talked about enablement, like in laying the foundation for successful sales enablement within an organization. Like what do those primitives actually entail? And what are the types of things you think about setting up day one?
Well, look, you know, in full transparency, I think in the beginning of Snowflake, I was the enablement person. So I kid you not, like I remember clearly there was one of our first BDR hires I hired out of University of Colorado, Tommy. And Tommy came in and I had to show Tommy what it was, how a computer connected to the internet. And then and like that, and I was like whiteboarding it for him. So, you know, and that's a kind of basic fundamental that, you know, as you're a sales leader, you actually own, I don't care if you're the head of sales or a frontline sales manager, you own enablement of your team. Ultimately, it's on you. And so at the beginning, it was on me. It was on me to show people on how to sell Snowflake. I would whiteboard the pitch. I would record how I did that. I would show that to everyone. But it was on me. I'm a very much a lead from the front salesperson or sales leader. So I need to know how to sell the product. And I expect all my sales leaders to know how to sell the product. If you have a sales leader that in Europe at any level of a, you know, startup, and unless you're like a massive, massive company, you need a sales leader that knows how to sell the product. Because otherwise, why are they there? Because they're a great operations person. I'm sorry, that's not going to build you a great company. And so to me, enablement starts with the sales leader. And then if you can, within enablement, you know, hire someone who's good at making it a full program. Okay, we brought in this company Force Management to help, show, you know, the sales methodology of MedPIC, and really make that, you know, a real living thing for the entire sales organization. we did that. And then we institutionalized that in our enablement so that when a new hire came on board, they were going through that. They were being trained on what Medic was or MedPIC was. And so you can do that through e-learning. But then you have to then make sure that it's in the system. So you make sure if you're using Salesforce, you need to have MedPIC fields that are filled out and really filled out. And you have to inspect those things. There's all sorts of things that go into enablement.
What question, if you were a CEO of a business, and at the end of the day, there is a scorecard to some extent that is reflective of how a go-to-market team is doing, but there's obviously a lot of inputs that go into that are outside of the go-to-market team's control related to the product and the market and marketing, as you alluded to, customer success, all these different things all kind of tie in together. Is there a question you would ask as a CEO that is the most confirmatory on whether or not the blame, if you miss a quarter, lies within the go-to-market organization versus somewhere else?
Well, you know, again, going to my training at EMC, the way that I view a sales leader in any level is there's kind of three things. You have to, first and most important thing as a sales leader or any leader, you have to hire great people. So if you hire great people, you develop those people, that will drive revenue. So the leading indicators are, can they hire? Like who's coming in the door? So number one, who's coming in the door? Number two is, are they being trained? And then you can look at the leading indicators. So like, you know, there's enough tracking tools out there today that you can see, are they going on sales calls? Like, are they able to go out and get meetings? And then are they able to convert those meetings to sales qualified opportunities? And then, you know, from that point on, are you then able to make a sales rep productive? That is ultimately, so for me, and what measured, you know, my success at Snowflake was the productivity of an individual contributor. Could we hire someone and get them to do a minimum well, after 6 months. So it's not like on the first day of the 6 month, it's the first day of the actual seventh month. By month, you know, seven, day one of month seven, can they actually sell $250,000 of net new ACV or ARR every quarter consistently? And that was the ultimate metric that I was managed by. And so what was happening is, our productivity was jumping through the roof. So we were seeing, like, in an inside sales organization, you're going to see, like, I don't know, $400,000 in productivity. We were seeing like $1 million in productivity from our inside sales team. We were seeing like $2 million of annualized productivity out of our sales reps. And that's what got the investors excited. Now, on the inverse, the investors were scared of Snowflake because, you know, there was a time when I actually met with someone who actually worked at Redpoint, is now at Snowflake, who told me, you know, that we needed to focus on profitability. And I and Mike Spicer was like, we've got to get market share before we focus on profitability, because our competitors are the largest companies in the world and they will kill us if we do not get market share. And we had product market fit. So I think the ultimate metric, you know, it's a long story short is it's the productivity of the sales team.
Yeah, got it. As you think about AI being injected into every organization, I'm curious how you think about that changing elements of sales and what types of things you think it can be utilized for versus what's going to stay true about sales as it is today, as it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago?
You know, I think what AI is going to be incredibly helpful with is task automation. So task automation on things like, hey, I was hand picking at the beginning of Snowflake. I was building my own lists of customers to send emails to. I was sending 2,500 emails, a week. If I could do it in a day, I was doing that. But that was like very, very manual. Like that's a thing that you know, AI will be really good at. The other thing is even when I was at the end of my tenure at Snowflake, we would look at because Snowflake's a consumption based model, we were actually using Snowflake's product in our AI product called Cortex to actually identify use cases by notes that were in Salesforce that were updated by the sales team. So like, hey, for example, how many data warehouse migrations, how many data science migrations was Snowflake doing? And we'd use AI to pick that stuff out and say, okay, great. We have these leading indicators. Can we track that? So I think there's just a bunch of more intelligence that you'll learn about, your sales team coming out of that. I do think that what will not be replaced is the relationship, because ultimately people buy from people, and as long as you're selling to another human, they want that relationship. And so I will tell you that one of my strengths is being a passionate salesperson, and that I would come in and be controversial about my competitors sometimes in terms of saying like, good luck, you're going to fail in 6 months and I'll talk to you in 6 months. And they would, and then I'd get back to them and we'd build this relationship, and that carries on. So I think the relationship part of the sales, as long as you as the salesperson know what you're talking about, you have to know what you're talking about. You build these trusted relationships and you help your customers get promoted and also other stuff, you'll end up being in a good spot. So I think the relationship, the human interaction can't not be replaced, at least for the near term.
In hiring sales reps and focusing on that like human interaction, what were the things that you would try to tease out in an interview that were non-negotiable for success within your organization?
So we did we did an actual early days. We did assessments of our sales teams. So basically, I took myself and all of the early Snowflake salespeople, and we all took these assessments. And in these assessments, we were looking for things that were consistent across people that were successful, because we had people that failed as well. And for us, it was highly intelligent salespeople that basically did not trust anybody, were very mistrusting of people, and high energy and sometimes even low social, because they were out there, when someone says, yeah, no problem, dude, I'll get you a deal, they would all be suspect of that. They'd be like, okay, tell me why. And that's part of the having a sales methodology is like, you're going to qualify, like, why now? Why us? Why anything? And those are the things that, really good salespeople start to do is even then when someone says that they're going to do something for them, they don't trust them. And I think that was probably, you're looking for that in their background. So for me, when we were early stage, I was not looking for people that managed one account. I was looking for people, show me in the last 2 years where you worked and you successfully opened up new logos. Tell me about those new logos. How many new logos did you open? Tell me about the deals that you lost. Tell me why you lost them. Tell me who was your champion when you won. Tell me who was the champion of your competitor when you lost. Like, these are things that you can ask in the interview to start figuring out if they're BSing, because like they could say, yeah, I won this logo. Okay, tell me more about that. Like, you could just ask like three levels deep, and all of a sudden their story starts to fall apart or it doesn't make sense, then you're like, okay, this person's full of it. So
you talked about how the quality of the team is one of the most important indications of a sales leader, and if they're consistently hiring great people around them. There's a tension that can exist between the need to hire people and ramp quickly with keeping the quality bar high for the totality of the people within the organization. Obviously, Snowflake went through hyper growth, but how do you think about that tension of needing to get butts in seats, but also making sure that the talent bar stays to a quality that allows the organization to continue to pursue excellence?
Well, so first of all, you have to agree on a hiring process, especially when you're hiring fast. I'll give you an example. I won't tell you the name of the company, but I'm advising in a company right now, that they're in the, they need to hire over 30 people right now. And their current hiring process, has multiple stakeholders in it. And at the end, it has a committee. You have to present to this group of people a panel interview. They have a 50% failure rate at the panel interview. And it's like, my head is exploding. And I'm like, okay, you can't do that. Number one is, how the heck does someone get to the panel interview and fail? Like, what is happening in that interview process? Like, you've got some fundamental issues there with that. And the reason why I hate the panel interview is you getting a group of people together, at any given time is going to be hard, from just a timing perspective. So if every single person has to be a part of a panel interview that you hire, you're screwed if you have to hire quickly. It's okay if you have to hire like one or two people a quarter, but if you're going to hire 30 people, 40 people in a quarter, no chance. And so you basically have to have an agreed upon hiring process that everybody follows. And there are basic things that you're looking for. We have to have these things in the fundamentals of it. So for us, we did our assessment was part of that. That there was the sales rep that we were going to hire. So the way that it worked is you basically have effectively four interviews. You have the hiring manager's selling on the first interview. They're hopefully talking to someone that is currently employed. Unemployed, I'm not super psyched on going out and hiring. There's got to be a really good reason why you're going to go hire an unemployed person. Number two is, all right, so you're selling the hiring manager. The second interview is you're buying. Like, okay, now you're doing the hard interview. Okay, great. Then you're going to have on the third interview, they're going to meet with your manager. And that manager is going to ask some really hard questions. And then finally, it's going to be the second the third line manager. So in my case, I interviewed in the early days of stuff, like all of the sales reps. And I was looking for, you know, all these things. Now I had a great recruiting partner, that worked with me, and this guy, by the name of Chad Pete. So Chad was incredibly influential, on it. And he would not, like, there are also, VPs of sales that say, I want to interview 10 people for this one position. Okay. Again, you're going to fail. So Chad would be like, I'm putting one to two people in front of you and you can say no, but these are the people, like, you've got to basically figure out, are these your people? And he's making sure he's qualifying that. We've done the assessments. He's making sure that he's babysitting that process. And we're getting through that process in 2 weeks. And when he would get on the phone with the candidate and they'd him and haw because they're employed. Okay, you know, Johnny, we're gonna at the end of 2 weeks, we're gonna make a decision on whether or not you're gonna work at Snowflake or not. But it's 2 weeks. So you have 2 weeks to go through this process. And at the end of 2 weeks, you're either gonna get an offer or you're gonna get declined, but you have to make a decision in 2 weeks. And if they say, oh, well, I just wanna, you know, meet them, get to know them, no. You're not in the process, not until you want actually to come and work at the greatest company. Here's what they're doing, blah, 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 blah. So you've got to have a good pitch and all this other stuff.
It's fascinating. I've heard you talk in the past about the board dynamics and maybe at different points in time. And I think you were being partially tongue-in-cheek, but also entertaining. And I think there's a kernel of truth in this, being somewhat distrusting of board members and VCs and the interests that maybe investors have versus executives within the company. Can you maybe speak a little bit to that dynamic and how you think about, as a go-to-market leader, interacting with investors and board members and all of that?
So Bob Muglia, you know, to quote him, said it best, is, you know, the board is your friend until they're not. Do not think of the board as your friend. They are not your friend. Their job is to make sure that the investors, the shareholders, are going to get a return on their investment. That is their job. And if for whatever reason they think that you are not going to give them that return, they will fire you in a heartbeat. And I've seen that. Firsthand. I watched some, like, you know, again, going through the, you know, Sloopman transition with Bob, that was wild. I mean, it was like boom, overnight. And so to me, you know, I learned a really good lesson. As you know, as the chief revenue officer, I was not trusting of any of the board members. I would ask them for help. We had some wonderful board members, everyone from John McMahon, Carl Eschenbaugh, but man, I didn't think that they were my friend. Cause again, they're in there trying to maximize value, shareholder value. And that's what Sloopman also said to me. He's like, look, do you think the board is, and he was just more just self-aware of it than Bob was, is he just said, do you think they're my friends? He goes, they could care less who I am. They want to make sure that they're going to make money, and that's it. And if you do not operate that way, you're mistaken. They are not your friend. And so I think I've just kind of gone into that knowing. And so, like, you know, look, when Sequoia invested in stuff like Carl Eschenbaugh is a world-class guy. He sat on our board and he's now the current CEO of Workday. I was very, you know, Carl came from VMware. They did 6-month quotas. I had never done 6-month quotas. And I would kind of do what VCs do to people when they're not really going to invest in the company and say, that sounds good, Carl. And so, like, when a VC, you know, and I've been in plenty of situations, there are a lot of VCs that passed up Snowflake for many reasons. And they would say, oh, yeah, that sounds great. We'll get back to you. And that's the VC way of saying, I'm not doing anything. We'll get back to you in a week, a month, a year, whatever it is, but not now. And so that would kind of be the thing for me, is I would never be, like, argumentative with a board member. But you got to be careful because you can't just, you know, say yes to them and not do it. So I would say, let me think about it. That would be the thing. I would never say no, but if I said yes to something, I would go out and do it. And that would be the thing that I would just encourage people to do, is just be aware. Like, if they're strongly suggesting something and you don't do it, you're going to probably lose your job. And so, you know, just like when Sloopman said, okay, you've got to reorg the sales team, in the middle of the year when he just arrived, I'm like, well, can we wait to the end of the year? And he's like, no. I'm like, okay, well, I guess I'm doing that, right? There's no choice. And so those are the things that you just have to be very, you know, self-aware. I think, you know, having a, you know, high EQ is helpful, in these roles, because you've got to read the room and you've got to figure out when like, they say something, how much you actually have to do it, because then you'll start to realize.
It sounds like you had a strong advocate and mentor in John McMahon, who's certainly a legend in selling in enterprise sales. And obviously the tree of people that have learned under him speaks for itself. But do you think that's important for a go-to-market leader to have an advocate the board level, be it ideally someone that's done it before or a legend in their field, but also potentially an investor, just someone that you know is in your corner, or was that just a unique set of circumstances to have someone like that, given the connection you had and my consumer logic that led to McMahon joining Snowflake's board?
I think it's critical. I mean, I think, look, I always tell the founders, you don't want to hire, like, people always reach out to me and say, I'd like you to be the chief revenue officer. And I'd say, no, you don't. You don't want me to be the chief revenue officer, because I'm not desperate. I was desperate when I took this job. I was desperate to be successful, and that matters. Me having McMahon on the board, it was incredibly impactful. Like, there's zero chance I would have made this journey without him. No chance. And so I owe a lot to John, because John very much, like I said, coached Bob through different phases and kind of helped me also help me recruit people. So, you know, when I was out there saying, you know, hey, John McMahon's on my board, it helped me recruit sales leaders. I had John interview people for me. I would recommend, if you want to build a strong enterprise sales team, I would recommend having a guy like John McMahon on the board, because I think it helps on the sales side in terms of recruiting great talent. It knows that, hey, the people that follow Medic, they know that you're the godfather of Medic is on your board. And they want to learn, and you want to come learn from a great sales leader. Like, these are all the things that, you know, good sellers are looking for. So for me, yeah, I would recommend having that. Now, what I also have come to find out, especially in the role I'm in now, is that there's a ton of arrogance in founders. Like, these young kids that went to, you name the Ivy League school, they think they know all. And I don't want to work with those people. In fact, I make it a point of not working with those people, because they think they're these unicorns. They built this great company, and they could do it their own way. Well, guess what? You could do it to your own way until you can't. And that you can't is you're going to fail, because you did something so stupid. You're wasting money. You're doing all these stupid things, and they're not willing to listen. And so to me, I'm looking for humble founders. I'm looking for smart founders. I'm looking for people that elicit feedback and ask for feedback and do stuff. But if you go to someone and say, well, we're unique, and my response is, no, you're not. No, you're not. And I don't, like, in the enterprise software space, you are not unique. And I'm like, Snowflake was this amazing, magical thing, but we had a sales process and a sales methodology that got us, like, getting, like, our first 100 customers was impossible. It was so hard. Imagine selling with no website. Imagine selling with, I had stealth mode on my LinkedIn profile. Those were all things that were really hard. And having a good sales methodology behind that was what I think kept us alive. So I think, those are all things that making sure that the founders value sales and putting someone like a McMahon on their board, they should absolutely do it.
I'm curious, you've worked under a number of, I would say, legends in the industry, is probably safe to say, between Spicer and Slootman and McMahon. These are some of the iconic names. And I guess I want to unpack a little bit of your biggest learnings or biggest takeaways from some of those people. So I guess question as it relates to John, what do you think has made John such a legendary sales leader in what he was able to do at, BMC and Blade Logic and PTC, but then perhaps even more interestingly, such a legendary sales mentor over the course of the last decade?
Yeah, I mean, look, John, what I think people think that John is this, like, hard ass. And what I would say is John is, but a lot of the guys that actually have worked in a John McMahon sales organization try to be John McMahon. And John and I have had this conversation. There's only one John McMahon. And you cannot replicate John. You can take and learn from John and try to do that. So a lot of these guys come out. And in fact, one of the reasons that I I took the job at Snowflake is there was a bunch of sales leaders that wanted me that actually had worked under John at BMC that wanted me to work for them. And all of them were a bunch of, and I don't mean to use a bad word, but assholes. They were just arrogant assholes. And I'm like, I'm not going to go. I was turning 40. I didn't want to go work for these people. I'm like, it was call it my midlife crisis, if you will. But number one is John is not an asshole. John is very, very metrics driven. John is very much like he has a way about him of figuring out, is this person doing what I'm telling them to do? Are they following the rules? Are they doing, do I believe what they're saying? He has this intuition that is just hands down amazing. John is hard. He'll hold you accountable, but he's not an asshole. Now, I'm sure people have been fired by John. I'm sure they're going to say he is, but he's really a very good guy that he, every time I get off the phone with John, I just talked to him last week. Every time I get off of him, he still says, call me anytime, Chris, call me anytime. So he has this way about him that he's a hard ass, but he has some empathy in him. And he's very much, someone that will listen and then act versus act, you know, and then deal with the consequences later. So, I respect the heck out of John. And he's like that. And Slootman is the same way. Slootman's like, hey, man, people would say, what's the Frank Slootman's playbook? And Frank's like, I don't have a playbook. It's situational. And I think that's, you know, all these great leaders that I've had to, you know, I've got an opportunity to work with, they have these intuitions that are just amazing. And it's situational leadership. It's not like, this is how you do it there. This is like, you have to be open to saying like, well, I did it this way over here, but it makes sense that you're doing it this way. Like Slootman had such a bad experience at ServiceNow launching Japan. And he looked me in the, because I was a sponsor for Snowflake Japan. He looked me in the depths of my soul, basically saying, I had this consultant in saying we should do it. He goes, he almost like said, go away to the consultant and said, Chris, are you going to make this successful? And I was like, it was a scary moment. And I had to look, you know, Frank in the eyes and say, Frank, I got this. And I was all in like that. I had to spend so much time launching Japan, and it was a lot of work, but great, you know, it turned out really, really great for Snowflake. So I think those are these guys are just have these unbelievable intuitions. And
it seems like one of the meta points in that is a level of perhaps self-awareness to not try to recreate like be John McMahon. It sounds like you were able to internalize a lot of different aspects of what made him successful without directly trying to emulate him. Is that a trait that you purposefully hire for, or is that a circumstance of your own personality?
You know, it's probably even, you know, goes back to like, you know, you were raised by your parents, and there are things that your parents did well. There are things that your parents didn't do well. And it's one of those things of like, okay, I want to take the good and try to make that part of how I bring up my kids. And that's no different than, but I want to take the bad out. Like, I don't, you know, like, hey, back in the day when I was growing up, you know, you get spanked, right? Like, guess what? That's not allowed nowadays, right? So there's different things that you just have to make sure that, okay, I'm going to learn from that. And so I think, you know, I worked for the same guy at EMC for 8 years. I learned so much from him, but there were a lot that I didn't like about how he treated people and stuff like that. But man, I learned a lot from him. So you know, to me, I'm so thankful for the guy that I worked for because he taught me so much, some of the fundamentals of sales. And I think it's just important to any leader that you take that good, you make it your own, and you not be an asshole about it. I think those are the things that you can still have empathy. You could still be a real human, but hold people accountable. And I think you learn from both your successes and failures.
You touched on some element of this with regard to Frank Slootman, but I'm curious, like, what's something that's maybe superhuman about Frank, and it's just like not replicable, but something that you admire? And then I'm curious, what is something that you were able to internalize, or you would recommend other people just do that you kind of learned from him?
Well, you know, Frank wrote a book, and you know, people are like, did you read the book? I'm like, no, because I lived it. You know, Frank would say things like, he has this like just innate ability to actually read people. His ability to read people is just second to none. And he's, so he could, you know, I'm a bad liar. And so he would know if I was bullshitting him. He would be like, okay, hey, Degnan's not is, I can read him so well that I know whether or not, you know, the forecast is going well, whatever it is. And I have a little bit of, you know, high anxiety about things. So he kind of liked that a little bit. But he would kind of then coach me down of saying like, dude, it's okay that you and I are worried about things. But you can't let everyone else know. You can't let the rest of the sales org know that you're super concerned about something. And so you would learn those things is like, okay, you need to exude confidence. Frank is a general. Like you look at Frank, you hear from Frank, you want to, once you get on Frank's side, you want to run through walls for someone like that. And I've never seen any leader like that. Frank has this crazy ability to lead. And his leadership style is very much, hard. And so he'd say things like, when there's doubt, there's no doubt. And he, you know, and he'd say like, you know, like when I'd want to go launch a new sales group, like a overlay group or something like that, he would say, okay, you know, silly, stupid things. He'd say like, eat like an elephant, poop like an ant, you know? And so stuff like that, like, okay.
What does that actually mean?
So it's basically like, you're going to go out and you're going to, you know, eat as much as you can, but with a very small amount of people. And so I think he just would very much like, you know, say, hey, go find someone who you can actually get the most leverage out of, but don't go out and hire a ton of people until you know that this group is going to be super successful. Then we'll scale it. But he's like, I'm not scaling it until we start to see, you know, the metrics come out of it. So there were a lot of things that I'd learned from him in the process. And again, it's his book, You Lived It. So he, in every one-on-one, you know, he would grill me, and he would grill me on all sorts of stuff, but I respected him. I respected how he went about things. He was not a jerk about it, but he was hard. And he held me accountable. And so I just, you know, I think that's important for everyone, is accountability matters. And I think that's something that Frank was really good at.
Yeah. Interesting. Now, what about Mike Spicer? Like what something that you learned from him, and what do you think makes him great at what he does?
Mike is a dreamer, and an incredible recruiter, probably the best recruiter I've ever met. He convinced me to take the job when I probably, you know, in hindsight, like when I walked in day one, I was like, what the hell did I get myself into? But, I think, Mike thinks so big. He would be like, you know, when, you know, we were early days of Snowflake, he'd be like, we're going to create $100 billion market cap company. And everyone in the room would be like, whatever, dude, like no chance. And sure enough, we have hit over $100 billion in market cap at some point. And I think sort of like, you know, trending in that direction, again. And I think, you know, the way that I look at, Mike is he has this really great ability to understand technology and then apply it to the business world and understand how big of a market it is. He only wants to chase massive markets. And I think he can recruit world-class people. When you get in front of Mike, you're walking out there so excited about what you know, what he just told you. And you know, sometimes it's fake it till you make it. And Mike does a little bit of that, of getting you excited about something that may not be 100% real, but you make it real. And that was really what was the magic of Snowflake.
Do you think there's advantages to actually being in stealth for an extended period of time, having lived it with Snowflake?
Certainly made it hard on me. The reason that Mike wanted Snowflake to stay in stealth was because we were going after, architecturally, we did something very different than anyone had ever done. And it was hard. And, you know, as we interviewed Bob Muglia, Bob came from years of working at Microsoft. And, you know, what Bob had said is there's probably like, you know, 10 to 20 people in the world that can build a database from scratch. Now, some of those people sat inside of IBM on Microsoft. And we luckily had three of those people that were working at Snowflake in our three founders. And he said, it's really, really hard to invent. Like most of the databases, like Amazon had launched, had bought some source code of a legacy database and launched it. And there was another data warehouse startup, forget the name of it, when Amazon launched Redshift, they completely steamrolled the company. And the reason they steamrolled the company, there was no competitive moat. They had taken an open source, I think it was open source Postgres, and just threw it out there and said, okay, we're going to make this a data warehouse. And that just didn't work. You need to have this competitive moat. So Mike was, and that's something that I've learned, by the way, when I talk to like seed companies, that is the thing that I want to look at the most, is like, what is your competitive moat? Technically, I don't care if you have a great business idea, it doesn't matter to me. But you need to have a great world-class technologists that are building those competitive moats. Luckily, Snowflake had really, you know, Benoit and Thierry, who were the original co-founders that had built Oracle, had some core principles, built parts of the Oracle database, and they had some core principles that they had were so married to. And they were like, this is what we're going to build for Snowflake. And it turns out that those principles mattered. And so Mike knew that. That's why he wanted us to stay stealthy, because he wanted to have an 18 to 20 month technology head start in front of people. So that's why he did it. It made it hard on me, but it also kept the competition at bay. In terms of knowing what we were doing. And people didn't even believe us or what we had done, because building it, as I said earlier, building a database from scratch is hard. So as we started to get out there, you actually had to show people all this stuff. And so the competition, the cloud providers, they didn't know what we were doing. I mean, even if they did, they didn't believe we could do it. And that's why it was helpful. That's not always the case that stealth matters. But again, you know, to Spicer's credit, if you want to build a big company, you have to have a deep competitive moat, and then you have to get market share before your competition gets problem. And that was really his whole theory: is okay, building a world class product, and then get market share. And that's ultimately what drove the success of Snowflake.
Snowflake, we were fortunate to be involved along the way. And as it sits here today, I'm looking, sitting at a $71 billion business, stock is right around 212. So a nice little run over the last bit under Sridhar's leadership and a lot of the work that you put in place over the course of the last couple of years. I don't know the right characterization or how you would articulate this or how it has been articulated, but there was a point in time that Snowflake was materially ahead and scaling way faster than Databricks was, who I think has become like one of the principal competitors out there, or like another business that's doing exceptionally well. And a lot of this initial AI movement, Databricks was able to do a good job capitalizing on. I'm curious, having lived that experience as an executive and one of the key people at Snowflake, what did you learn from that experience, and what would you recommend about, I don't know, paranoia for competitors or things that you would advise for companies going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly have a lot of passion on this subject. You know, look, we were, you know, years ahead in terms of market share with Databricks, and there was a point where we actually were partnering with them for a short bit. You know, ultimately, Snowflake, we optimized Snowflake to go public, and that meant, you know, creating leverage in the sales team and also the engineering team, just the whole company. So you're creating a more profitable company. And you know, Databricks even to this day is private. They're not profitable. Like examples are like they just bought a company called Neon, where they paid over $1 billion for Neon, and Snowflake had offered. Snowflake just bought a company. It's public information, called Crunchy Data, for $250 million. Well, they had a deal to buy Neon as well at a similar price point. And Databricks doesn't care about profitability or dilution to their shareholders, so they just go out and buy and buy and buy and buy. There actually is some goodness that comes out of what Databricks is doing. Because they don't care about those things, they can go build these massive engineering teams. So Snowflake's about $1 billion ahead, rough and tough, about $1 billion ahead in revenue. Maybe it's the gap is closed a little bit, but their sales team is two times the sales size of the sales team of Snowflake. Their engineering team is two times the size of the team of Snowflake. Snowflake's a public company now. Snowflake has to operate and generate free cash flow and show they're doing all these things to run a successful business. Databricks has to do none of that. And there seems to be a willingness for people to continue to invest at really crazy valuations of a non-public company that has no intentions of going public anytime soon. And I think what the miss on Snowflake's behalf was that, you know, our North Star was to be this cloud data warehouse. We hit that North Star, the number one cloud data warehouse. We won. And we should have kept going. And we should have put our foot on the gas, and we should have run right over Databricks. And we should have launched a notebook, a data science notebook. So if I diagnosed, and I did diagnose where Databricks is getting into our best customers, where they were getting into the data science team, and we weren't getting access to those people. And those data scientists were then building a bunch of, you know, workflows or ETL jobs with Spark. Geez, if we had only done that, if we only built a notebook, if we only had hosted Spark, but there were some core principles the engineering team didn't want to do, if we had done those things, Databricks would have been dead. We would have killed them. And we gave them air. And we gave them air because we didn't build out, you know, some of those functionality, and we waited too long. Now we have those capabilities, but Databricks has a huge head start. But we had a bigger sales team, bigger customer base, more loyal customer base, less complex product. We could have killed them, and we gave them air. And it's really unfortunate, I think that we did, because that was a huge miss. And that was on, like, hey, look, this is always, looking in the rearview mirror is always easy to say, like, hey, this, we didn't know it at the time, but geez, there were some decisions we should have made earlier around some stuff that we missed, and we gave them life when we could have just crushed them.
I'm curious, like, that's the diagnosis at the tactical level of, like, how it sort of played out. I guess at a zoomed out strategic level, is the lesson just stay paranoid about all your competitors always and think through the low probability scenarios that might play out? Or How do you, if you're a founder listening to this and trying to think about how to actualize that for themselves, what lesson did you take away that might be a little bit more zoomed out?
Listen to your customers. I mean, if you listen to your customers and understand, like, never be in a situation where you're telling a customer this is how it has to be. Be in a situation where you have to listen to your customer and you take their feedback and you act on that feedback. So the customers were telling us, okay, this is why we're bringing in Databricks. Okay, why? Well, our data scientists need a world-class data science tool set. Okay, great. They have a world-class notebook. We should have bought a company. There's a great company called Hex. We should have bought Hex. And we didn't because it wasn't core to Snowflake. So to me, it's don't be arrogant enough to think that your customers, know better than you. They do know better than you because they're buying. They're speaking with their wallets. And you have to listen to them. And if you give these companies air, then it is what it is. And that's what we did. And so I think, to any founder out there is like, be curious and be humble and take feedback. Because if you don't do that, there is going to be someone. I don't care who you are. This is going back to like, meeting some of these founders of companies is like, they think they're unique until they're not. And this is like, like I said, with Bob Muglia, the board is your friends until they're not. Like, you just have to be self-aware. You have to listen. And if you do not listen and you do not read the tea leaves of why is something happening, then you're missing out. And I think it's hard because as you're building a company, there are things that can distract you. Like for Snowflake, I clearly remember we went into this meeting at one of the major investment banks early on, and they'd say, this was when private cloud was a big thing. And they were like, hey, we've been trying to build what you guys have built. When are you going to run in the private cloud? And our founder, Benoit, was like kind of master Yoda. And he said, hey, you'll go to the public cloud ever before we go to the private cloud. And sure enough, that investment bank was our first real big investment bank customer and still a big Snowflake customer to this day. So I think, the reality of it is like, there are some bets that you have to make that like, okay, core principles, like, hey, I'm not going to build on the private cloud, or I'm not going to build in the data center, whatever those things are. Those are some core principles that you kind of have to agree on. But there are other things that you have to be willing to, give up and sacrifice. And sometimes you miss on those bets.
I'm curious, one of the things that was implied in your diagnosis of Databricks and how they were able to execute in a great way with regard to some of the bets that they've been able to make was some implied advantages, or maybe explicit advantages, in being in the private markets and not having the same quarterly cadence and public rhythm of needing investors to be on board to the same extent that happens in the public markets. One, can you unpack that a little bit? And do you think that the implication of that is that companies actually should stay private longer when they're taking some of these more ambitious bets? Or where do you fall on that side of the spectrum?
Look, there are a lot of things I don't think Databricks is doing well. So I can't say, like, and again, if I'm a shareholder, if I'm an employee, like, even like, these are things that you just kind of don't understand, especially when you're like a frontline person. Maybe you're a sales rep or a frontline engineer or something like that. Sometimes you don't think about these things, but like, at the same market cap that Databricks is trading in the private market, this is prior to this Neon acquisition, they were trading at about roughly $90 a share. At the same price point, Snowflake was trading at about $130 a share because they're more dilutive. They don't have any cash to buy companies, so they buy it with equity. So they dilute, and so the CEO, he thinks he's doing the right thing. Maybe he is. But I've talked to a lot of VCs and say, show me a company that's ever been private for this long and been successful. And you know, in the long run. So again, at some point, the investors are going to force his hand to go public at some point because they want liquidity, right? Now, in this world, there is, you know, a decent sized private market for a bunch of companies. A bunch of Elon Musk companies are private companies, but they have a liquidity. OpenAI has liquidity. So like, I don't know if it's right or wrong. But again, if you are going after huge markets, AI is a huge market. So Anthropic, OpenAI, xAI, they're going after these, like, I don't know the size of their market. It's ginormous. There's some niceness of being private because you do not have to worry about things around profitability or path to profitability. As long as investors will give you money, and I think Databricks is in that boat, is they continue to almost imply they're going to get the profitability, but they're not, and they're continuing to lose money. So to their credit, they can go buy companies. They can go spend 3x more than what Snowflake will buy on a company. They've done it multiple times. They bought a company called Tabular. Snowflake had a deal to buy Tabular. Like, there's a bunch of stuff that they can do that Snowflake couldn't do. So there is some validity in what they're doing. Whether or not that's right, time will tell. I don't know. This is not an area where I'm going to be an expert.
In going from the private to the public markets, what changed for you most in terms of how you ran the day-to-day of the business? And ultimately, do you think it made Snowflake a better business than it was in the private markets? Or is that kind of a narrative that you think VCs maybe put out there to try to get liquidity?
Well, it's not just for the VCs, it's for the employees. I mean, look, you know, you work at, I don't know what the average tenure of an employee is. You know, look, you know, an average tenure for head of sales is probably 18 months. You know, for me to do it for 11 and a half years is probably, there's not a lot of longevity historically in heads of sales. So, you know, I think it's most important for the employees to have liquidity because there's so much of your wealth that can be built in this one company. And if you can only sell 10% of your stock, you know, and that's typically what happens in a privately traded company, it's hard, especially if you want to go do another job at another company, because you're kind of handcuffed, you know, with these companies. I think so. To me, it's not just for the VCs. To me, it's also for the employees. And you know, can you create wealth for these employees? Especially when you're, you know, if you've been there from the beginning. I can only imagine some of these employees that have been at Databricks for a long time, they've been able to sell some, but in theory, I could sell all of my stock in Snowflake if I wanted to. And they can't. Because there are some handcuffs, you know, put on you when you're traded as a private company. So, to me, having liquidity is really important, I think, for employee retention, employee morale, and stuff like that. I think that's probably the most important thing. Now, in terms of operating the company day to day, yeah, I mean, look, we have quarterly earnings, we have things that we have to make sure that we focus on. And there's a bunch of, you know, things around profitability. You know, Wall Street cares about free cash flow. So we had to make sure there are things that we've had to do to make sure that we hit those free cash flow targets and making sure that we operate in a lean fashion, which again, can be good for the company and the shareholders. You're generating shareholder value. And I think this is, to Sridhar's credit, he's reaccelerating growth at a publicly traded company and running a lean machine. I think he's a world-class operator and he's doing a great job, but it's a lot harder. His job is a lot harder than Ali is at Databricks because he doesn't have those things that he has to think about.
You've had a great partnership with your longtime counterpart at the CMO role within Snowflake, so much so that I think you guys are working on or writing a book together about that relationship. And I don't want to give away the totality of the insights in the book, and people should read it when it comes out. But I'm curious, what is the kernel that has made that relationship so successful? And what would you pass along to other companies that are trying to make those sometimes competing responsibilities or roles work well together?
Yeah, so you know, I talk about this all the time with the companies that I advise, and I learned this from again Frank Slootman when I asked when Snowflake went public, we became tech famous. Snowflake did, and a lot of the executive team became tech famous, and so I got a lot of requests to be on, whether it's advisor or board or whatever. And I went, I had to get Frank's approval. And I went to Frank and he said, you know, look, it'll be a really good thing for you to do, because you'll see how messed up. He didn't use messed up. I won't say what the other word he said.
You can say, I think we have the explicit tag on our Spotify and Apple account. So I think we're comfortable here.
You'll see how fucked up other companies are. I laughed. And so then I, you know, one of my first advisory roles, I was like, holy cow, the CEO, almost relished the friction between sales and marketing and would create this awful, you know, competitive situation between sales and marketing. And, you know, when we were growing, I was doing my own demand generation. I was like the demand generation machine for Snowflake. And that was, and John McMahon was like, dude, you're going to get fired if you don't fix this. And so that's when we went out and hired Denise, and she's a demand generation focused CMO. And the first thing that she did, because I was arguing with the previous regime around what an MQL was, what an SQL was, like how many of the MQLs should I see, all this other stuff. And she said, I'm going to stop right now. The day one, you are my customer, and we're going to talk about meetings, and we're going to talk about qualified meetings. And that's all we're going to talk about. And then she would go and sit down, and I ran the SDR team. She would go sit down with the SDRs. Then she'd go and meet with the sales team and say, okay, tell me about the leads you're getting from the SDRs. And then she created her whole demand generation program around making sure that we got qualified meetings. And to me, that was like, she treated me as customer number one. She treated our sales team as her customer. And she trained her entire team to treat us as the customer. And so to me, revenue matters the most. I mean, I don't care whatever anyone says in an enterprise software company. I don't care if it's AI, whatever it is, revenue matters. And so she knew that. And she said, I got to get you in front of customers and prospects and generate pipeline for you. And that was the start of this wonderful partnership that Denise and I have had. So yeah, we are writing a book about our journey, because like there are so many founders that have never managed a sales and marketing team that think there's friction and they should say, well, this marketing team is going to generate this many leads. You guys aren't touching those leads. That's a constant. And she would always be like, no, we're not having that conversation. Her and I would have it privately around, okay, what's working, what's not. And each one of us would take action, and even like take action on people. So if there were people that were cancerous to either organization, we would make changes based on feedback that we would get from each other. So we just built this really close relationship on working together. And I think that's incredibly important, is having a great go-to-market organization involves both sales and marketing. Sales can't do it alone without marketing. And I think that was the really important thing that kept Snowflake's engine going. And Denise is the best in demand generation, in the one of the top, if not the top, chief marketing officers in the software space. And so I was super lucky to get to work with her and her team, and she built a world class team underneath her.
When does the book actually come out?
Coming out this fall. Let It Snow, I think that's the name of it. So I think we're going to go with that. And it's kind of a biographical, you know, story of Snowflake, but told in how we built the go-to-market machine of Snowflake. So we're excited about it. Yeah.
Well, I will encourage people to check it out when it comes out. Snowflake has been a prolific source of of books that thus far, I guess, with Frank's book as well. And so excited to read it. So I guess maybe we can wrap with a few rapid fire questions. Sure. And I guess the first one, do you think sales led and product led, sort of the PLG motion, do you think those things can truly coexist within a business, or does one of those ultimately win out in the fullness of time?
I think it would have been great if we had, you know, a PLG motion first. Like, hey, that would have been great if we had a bunch of leads that were coming in that people were using the product first. We were, there was complexity to our sales motion. We're selling a database. And so we needed a very much a hands-on approach to doing it. And so we focused on scaling out the go-to-market engine and built the whole team around doing proof of concepts and stuff like that. It worked out well for us. If you can have PLG at the same time. So what we did is we focused initially on, 100% guarded, on who could touch the product, when they could touch it, all this other stuff, to then, driving a self-service motion. So more of a PLG motion that came later. Denise then focused the marketing team's effort on driving people to the self-service portal so that people could sign up. Look, there's nothing that like more awesome than getting highly qualified leads that are in the pipeline. Eventually, even if you're a PLG led organization, you need an outbound motion. You need, to continue to scale your org. So I think they absolutely should coexist. If you're having a ton of success right off the bat with PLG, lean into that. But eventually start in your mind, like think of the likes of Anthropic. Anthropic's, building out their go-to-market machine now. But they were very much a PLG-led organization. They have a huge consumer business, but they are focused on selling into the enterprise now. And so I think there's a ton of that matters. And I I'm not going to say anyone is better than the other, but invest, get market share as fast as you can. But you're going to need the other one eventually, whether that's the PLG or whether that's enterprise. Software, if you aspire to sell into the large enterprise, you're going to need those motions.
What's one tactic or adage or something in enterprise sales that sounds smart, but you actually believe is totally incorrect or maybe just very overrated?
The products sell themselves. I mean, people think that, it was easy selling Snowflake. I when I would do new hire trainings at Snowflake, even like the last new hire training I did, I told the people in the room, there are people in this room that will fail, because there are basic fundamentals that you have to do to be successful in a sales job. So the core fundamentals were, for me, we had a great product. You have to go tell that story 8 times a week. So 8 face-to-face meetings a week is like, you got to do it. And by the way, it's grunt work. It's to pick up the phone and cold call people and ask them to meet with you. They don't want to meet with you, right? And force your way into an opportunity. Those are the things that people think are easy, because, and that was a huge misperception of Snowflake. People would come into Snowflake thinking, look at how great that company is. I remember talking, there's plenty of sales leaders that we've hired that have said that to me. On the outside looking in, it looked really, really easy. But in the reality is, like, every day we're knife fighting. And so I was looking for where I couldn't hire people from a Salesforce and have them be really successful at Snowflake, because Salesforce is like 98% market share. They don't know how to open up new logos. They know how to manufacture deals around pricing structures and relicensing things and stuffing other products into the deal. They do not know how to create demand. They do not know how to sell through an actual campaign. And so to me, that's where the big difference is actually figuring out, like, does a salesperson have the ability to generate their own demand? and close deals. Because to me, like, that's the misperception that this journey itself, like, was this super easy journey. It was never easy.
I guess as we hop, I'm curious, like, what's the biggest red flag that you see when talking to a founder or an early sales team that makes you think they just don't have the understanding of what it's actually going to take?
Again, it's arrogance. There's this founder I've met a couple times of a company that's doing quite well, but doesn't believe in traditional sales. And I'm thinking to myself, like, okay, like, you know better than, you know, I don't know how many years of enterprise selling there is. I don't think you do. And I think it goes back to being arrogant. If you think your shit don't stink, you're wrong. And I think, again, like, it comes back to my favorite founders to work with are people that want feedback and act on that feedback and are humble enough to admit that they're wrong and act quickly. And if you do not do that, I don't want to work with you. Because I think that's, like, the reality of it is like, you know, you can, because you have a great product, it can get you to a place, but that place will come to an end. And it's better to get ahead of it, and make sure you have a great product and a great go-to-market organization together. And that's when you really can crush it.
I guess, one final one as we wrap, what has you most excited today as you start to move into more board roles and advisor roles for business? What's the thing that gets you most excited?
Finding the next Chris Degnan. I mean, I was a frontline sales manager at EMC. I was a second line manager for a hot minute. And, you know, there were a lot of people that developed me, from Bob to Frank to John McMahon to Carl Eschenbaugh, even Sridhar. And so to me, I want to develop the next generation of sales leaders. And to me, that's the most exciting part that I get. People always say, hey, Chris, you want to be a CEO? Absolutely not. I do not want to be a CEO. I want to help build great go-to-market organizations, and I want to help develop the next great sales leaders. Like, to me, that's what gets me up out of it.
Well, Chris, thanks for doing this. This is great. I have a ton of respect and admiration for how you've led throughout the Snowflake journey. And as an investor, a longtime investor, I guess, at Redpoint, and a personal investor as well, I'm super appreciative of all the hard work you've done, and so excited to see what these next chapters look like for you.
Awesome. Well, Logan, it was great talking to you. Thank you for your time, and thanks for having me on your podcast.
Awesome. Thanks, Chris.